सहनौ भुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै। ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्ति। ॐ नमो भगवते। ॐ नमो वायवस्वताय मृत्यवे वायवस्वताय ब्रह्मविद्याचार्याय ब्रह्मविद्याच नचिकेतसे च नचि। Very good. Welcome back. We will continue. We just began verse 12 of the second section. And we saw only the first couple of words of this passage. And this passage, verse 12, is really where the text takes a big shift, a shift away from setting the context and a shift towards unfolding the highest truths of the ancient rishis. So that pure Vedantic teaching really begins in this text with verse 12. Let's recite it. Tam durdarsham, tam durd. Gudhamanu pravishtam, gudhamanu guhahitam, guha gahvareshtam puranam, gahvareshtam adhyatma yoga, adhyatma adhigamena devam, adhigamena matvadhiro, matvad. Harsha shokau jahati, harsha shokau. So this verse begins to unfold Atma Swarupa, the true nature of the self, and it does so with some of the words are scattered about in the last line, matva, matva, having understood devam, the prior word. Devam here doesn't mean God. It has more the literal meaning of the one that shines, as I mentioned in the last class. The word deva comes from the root div, which means to shine. The shining ones are the gods. Here we're talking about not a particular god or deity. We're talking about that which shines within the consciousness, which is your true nature. Now, to explain the words of this verse properly, we need a little broader context. We need to approach this text as the ancient rishis approached this subject matter. In our Q&A session, we talked about how this subject matter is unlike any other subject matter, which is to say knowledge of Atma is categorically unlike knowledge of anything else. So we need to establish what is the difference between knowledge of Atma versus knowledge of anything else? And in order to do that, we need to begin, sorry to say the obvious, we need to begin at the beginning, and I'll do so by putting some stuff up on a board. Thank you. So we're going to begin an inquiry into the nature of Atma in the most fundamental way possible, following the teachings of the ancient rishis, and this will properly introduce this verse. So we begin by trying to define Atma, self, with reference to other things. Usually when we define anything, it's always with reference to something else. So here, we're going to begin, in fact, let me just stop blabbering here, and let me just start with the words that Sri Shankara and all the great teachers use, and that's a distinction between drik, seer, and drishya, seen. So this is where we begin our inquiry. It's not the end, it's the beginning. Wait till you see where this goes. So we begin with this fundamental distinction in In fact, the entire world can be broken down into these two categories. Drik, seer, which is you, and drishya, seen. This process that we're doing is called viveka. Viveka means discernment, discrimination, telling the difference between two things. So we're going to go through this process of viveka right now. And what we're going to see is it has several layers. And this happens to be only the first layer. It's the most obvious one. Right now you see me. So therefore, if you want to identify self, you are the seer, and Swami Tadatmananda is the seen. You, the one sitting in this lecture hall looking at me, you are Drik, seer, and Swami Tadatmananda sitting on his chair is Drishya, seen. Take it a step further. We understand, we haven't gone through it in this class, but you've probably heard me discuss in another class, that whatever we perceive is actually being perceived in our minds. And to draw a little bit upon science, we know how sight works. Eyes pick up light. The light gets focused on the retina. Retina converts it into nerve impulses, goes to our brain. And miraculously, it seems like a miracle, in our minds is formed an image. So the point here is the image of Swami Tadatmananda that you see in the most direct sense is not the Swami Tadatmananda sitting on his chair, but rather the Swami Tadatmananda which has been reconstituted, as it were, in your mind. So that leads us to a different perspective. So it shows that drishya is not a very helpful, it's not complete, it's not adequate, because it's really with regard to sight. Or we could apply it to hearing, taste, touch, or smell. It sets up a subject-object relationship. Oh, I forgot that. That's step zero. So I started with step one, so now we have to have step zero. I should have started with step one, which is, we're going to make this distinction. Who are you? You are not an object. If you are not an object, you must be the subject. That's pretty simple. We use these terms in grammar all the time, but we can use these terms now in this context. Anything that is an object is not you, correct? You are the subject who knows objects. For example, you are the subject who knows Swami Tadatmananda as an object. So that's why we went to Drik and Drishya. So you are the subject. Anything, you are not the best. What a definition of you. Who are you? You're not an object. What's left? The world only has two possibilities. There are objects and there is subject. There's no third entity. So if we say you're not the object, you are the subject. What is the nature of that subject? Now we go to step one. You are the seer. Things are seen, which means anything seen by you is not you. Anything seen by you as an object, by definition, it is not you. Now we can proceed. Sorry for the little detour. Now we acknowledge, as I explained just a moment ago, that whatever we see, hear, taste, touch, or smell, is really all present in our minds. Our senses collect that information from the world around us, and it all gets presented to us in the form of images or perceptual thoughts, vrittis we call them, in our minds. So in a sense, what you are seeing is not the physical Swami Tadatmananda sitting here in a seat, but what you are seeing is an image in your mind, leading us to a little different expression. We could say, instead of you being the seer of objects, you being the drik, the seer of objects, drishya, we could say instead that you are the witness, the awareful witness of whatever is present in your mind. Right now, the image of Swami Tadatmananda is present in your mind. And you're aware of that image of Swami Tadatmananda in your mind. We could say that you witness the presence of that image of Swami Tadatmananda in your mind, leading us then to the second of our perspectives, or third if we want to call it such, the next. So we say then that you are the Sakshi witness of whatever is the contents of your mind. We could call it sakshya, which is witnessed, or let us say vrittis, which are mental events. So this is a further level of detail. In fact, each one of these steps is a further level of detail. In a broader sense, you are the subject, you are not an object, you are aware of objects, and those objects can be seen by you. If an object is seen by you, you are the drik, the object is drishya, seen. But then, when we recognize that those objects are actually in a form of vrittis in your mind, we can say you are the sakshi, you are the witness, the awareful observer, and whatever you witness is, the technical term is sakshya, but that's not a very common word. So we'll say that you are, what you're aware of are various vrittis, the activities of your mind. You with me so far? Now, what is a sakshi? What does it mean to say you are the witness of your mind? It seems a little bit like you're someone sitting in front of a television set watching whatever goes on the screen of your mind. It seems like then that's a metaphor we've used in other classes in a very extensive way. I don't want to do that today. But it's as though you're watching whatever is projected on the screen of your mind. Only difference is, for your mind, you don't get one of these. It'd be nice if there were, wouldn't it? Do you agree? If we could control whatever was going on in our mind as simply as you can control a remote control, how wonderful that would be. That's certainly not the case. Okay, but we recognize that you do observe what happens in your mind. You are the witness of those activities of your mind. So I'm asking this question. What does it mean to be the witness of anything? To be the witness of anything means to be conscious, to be awareful, right? In fact, to be conscious of a particular thing means to be the witness. To observe something, to be aware of something, to have that relationship between knower and known. Observer and observe. That's what we mean by witness. You can't be a witness of nothing. But the essence of that witness, if we ask what is the essence of that witness, its essential nature is to observe. It's to observe in a sense of internal observation, observing the activities of your mind, or to use more exact terminology, the essential nature of that sakshi is to be conscious of what's happening in your mind. We use these terms in English, consciousness and awareness, and we use them as synonyms, so we're not going to make any distinctions. And I should mention this, we're about to launch into a very profound discussion, and if we're not clear about the meaning of our terminology, we're going to get in big trouble. So in this class, I'll always use the terms consciousness and awareness as synonyms. There's no distinction at all. And by consciousness or awareness, we mean that by which mental events are known. That's our definition. That by which vrittis are known, that by which you know what's happening in your mind, that's what we mean by consciousness or awareness, which means a lot of our modern usage of consciousness is real different. And consciousness and awareness. How about environmental awareness? Completely different meaning, right? Environmental awareness. Or another mistake we commonly make is the use of the word consciousness in a medical community is utterly different than our usage of the term consciousness. So to a doctor, consciousness means the extent to which the patient can respond. If the patient responds normally, the patient is conscious. If the patient responds partially, the patient is less than conscious. If the patient responds not at all, the patient is unconscious. So these are not our usages of the word consciousness. So set aside that medical usage, set aside any other meaning of awareness or consciousness. We use them specifically and only to mean that by which your vrittis, your mental events, are known. Okay, enough said. So that leads us into the next in our series, which is to say that you, the subject, at one level you are the seer of objects which are seen, at another level you are the witness of mental events in your mind. Now at a deeper level we can say you are chit, consciousness. And what are you aware of? And this gets a little technical now. You can't really say you're aware of vrittis because this is not the time for a big, complicated discussion. Vrittis are consciousness. You can't say your consciousness is aware of consciousness. Don't worry about the details. We'll come to this perhaps at a much later time. But just to make it simple, this is kind of cheating. Chidvishaya, which means objects of consciousness. You are chit, consciousness, and what are you aware of? Chid vishaya, objects of consciousness. Whatever that might mean, and we're not going to explore that right now because it won't take us to this. Actually, it's taking us in the wrong direction. It's taking us towards the mind and world. We want to go in this direction towards the nature of the self. So this is a topic we'll take up. At some point it'll come in our text, I'm not sure exactly where, but now is not the time for this discussion. So, first we said you are the subject as opposed to objects, and we said no, you're not the subject, you're actually a seer of objects, and we said not exactly a seer, you're the witness of mental activities. Well, not exactly the witness, you are consciousness, aware of objects of consciousness. Now we come to the last question. What is this consciousness? And we just had this in satsang, I think, last week. The question is consciousness something you possess? And intuitively, many of you would say, yeah, I possess consciousness. But watch this. This is very important. Let's spend a few minutes on this. So incredibly important. We say that when we say I am consciousness, we misinterpret it to say I possess consciousness. Those two statements are different. I am consciousness is what Vedanta says. I have consciousness is how we interpret it, right? I possess consciousness. I am a being, I am a person, and I possess consciousness. Just like I possess I possess a car, I possess clothes, I possess a body, and by the way, I also happen to possess consciousness. But when we say I am consciousness, isn't that the implication? I possess consciousness. And here's why we do not possess consciousness. This is a huge error, a tremendous blunder. And this is what we saw in satsang. That which you possess is something that you could be deprived of and you still exist because you're the possessor. If you lose a possession, you, the possessor, you still exist. If you possess a car, if the car is stolen, you still exist. You possess clothes, if your clothes are stolen, you still exist. You possess a body. In dream, you are functionally without your physical body, yet you still exist. So in this way, these are truly possessions. Your car is a possession. Your clothes are a possession. Your body is a possession. That which you can be deprived of and still exist is a possession. You're the possessor. Now, can you give up consciousness? Who are you in the absence of consciousness? Someone could take away your car. Someone could take away your clothes. Your own body goes away during dream and sleep. But yet you continue to exist. In the absence of consciousness, who are you? Uh-oh. You get it? In the absence of consciousness, you don't exist. Consciousness is not a possession. Consciousness is your fundamental nature. It's who you are. It's not a possession. It's who you are. So to say we have consciousness, we use that term loosely. Maybe we use it in a medical sense. I have consciousness. I'm alert. I'm responsive. But that's not our Vedantic usage. You do not, it sounds funny to say this, you don't have consciousness. None of you. But you get it. You don't have it because you are it. Okay? You're with me? Very, very important. So you are that consciousness, which means that consciousness is you. This is the final step. That consciousness happens to be you. So, consciousness is you, Atma. Atma is the word we use for self. And then, what's on the other side of this dividing line of subject and object, if Atma is on this side, what's on the other side is Anatma, of course, not self. I am on this side. Everything else is on this side. I am on this side, everything else. Everything else means everything else in the world. And I have to apologize in advance. Every time I tell this, use that expression, I hear my teacher's words in 1981, the first time I heard him. And his accent was rather strong in those days. Even now it's fairly strong, but get used to it. But I still remember hearing him for the first time when he went on talking about myself and everything else. And it took me a while to figure that one out. There's I and there's everything else. All right. I guess this Tamil and Malayalam have that kind of expression. I still hear his voice, even after all these years. This is the most fundamental distinction. In order to understand Atma, self, we have to understand, really, at all these levels. And you see what we've done is we've gone from something more general to something more, I can't say precise, more fundamental. How's that? We go from the general to the fundamental. In the most general sense, you are the subject, everything else is an object. And then in a somewhat less general, you are the seer of objects, objects which are seen to you. At a more fundamental level, then you are the witness of activities in your mind, more fundamental. Yet you are the consciousness by which those mental activities are known. And finally speaking, who are you? You are you. You are that Atma. And everything else, by definition, is anatma. Now, this viveka, this process of discrimination, of discerning what is subject, what is object, what is seer, what is seen, what is witness, what is object, etc., what is atma, what is anatma. This is an essential tool in understanding your nature, and it's an essential tool in understanding our texts. So that's why I've introduced it here. We call this a prakriya. Prakriya means a teaching methodology. So now that we have this prakriya, this teaching methodology, we can use it in properly understanding this verse. We just started the verse in the prior class. We can proceed now. You remember we get... Why don't we leave the light on, I think. Yeah, thank you. So remember we get the connection. Devam matva. Matva, having discovered, having understood, what? Devam, that shining one, meaning that consciousness which is your true self. Now we go to the beginning. Tam, that one which is durdarsham. We saw that word in the last class. It literally means hard to see, hard to discover. Now we can understand why. Why is it dur-darsham? Something which is darsha, drishya and darsha have the same meaning, that which can be seen. So the verse says that atma, your true nature, is difficult to see. Not difficult, impossible. So difficult that it's impossible. Why is it impossible to see? Because you are the seer. That which is an object is different from the subject. That which is seen is different from the seer. Therefore, since Atma is the seer, Atma cannot be seen. And this is exactly what we talked about in the Q&A session. And that is that consciousness, chit or chaitanya, which is also a synonym, chit, chaitanya, consciousness, awareness, we use all these words as synonyms, cannot be perceived, cannot be experienced. Why? It's not an object. Doesn't that become very clear from this chart on the board? That which is an object can be seen, can be perceived, can be witnessed, can be experienced. But that which is not an object cannot be seen, cannot be witnessed. You can't be conscious of it because it is consciousness. This is the idea. Therefore, dur-darsham, literally difficult to see, but now we understand impossible to see because it's not an object that can be seen whatsoever. It's the nature of the seer. It is the nature of the drik. And it is gudham. It is hidden. How is it hidden? Guha hitam. In the second line, guha hitam. It is gudham, hidden, hidden. Actually, we'll take it, connect it to the next word. We'll take that guha hitam later. It is gudham, hidden. Why? Being anupravishtam. Anupravishtam is not an ordinary word. So, Sri Shankara says, gudham gahanam anupravishtam prakrita vishaya vijnanaihi prachannam. Shankara makes it very clear. Gudham, hidden. Hidden in what sense? Prachannam, covered. Covered by what? Prakrita vishaya. Prakrita vishaya, what did he say? Jnana. Prakrita vishaya vijnanaihi. Covered by, to use our word on the board, vrittis, covered by mental activities. I'm going for, looking for a metaphor right now. It's ironic that the consciousness we seek, oh boy, if we go there, we're going to have a hard time finishing one verse tonight because this is such a profound inquiry. I'm trying to think of a way to delay one topic for now. The relationship between consciousness and mind, I would like to delay for a later date. Otherwise, we won't be able to see any of this. That's what I said about delaying that with regard to chit. Let's just. Prakrita visha vijnanaihi prachannam. Take it in this way. Prakrita Vishaya means ordinary worldly things. Prakrita Vishaya Vijnana is our understanding, our knowledge and experience of ordinary worldly things. So I'm going to give it a little. Actually, I'm going to follow Shishankara, I think. I think what he means here by that expression, we're explaining anupravishtam in the verse, and it is to say that we experience so many worldly objects, and we find many of them fascinating. All kinds of things are fascinating. You have your smartphone, that's pretty fascinating, or whatever it might be. In the world are so many things that draw our attention, and they draw our attention because, this goes back to the beginning of our text, they draw our attention because we think they're objects of happiness. We think we can find contentment and peace and joy through those various objects. Therefore, we find them attractive. Therefore, our minds are constantly drawn to those prakrita vishaya, to use Shankara's language. Our minds are constantly drawn out there into the world, and as long as our minds are being attracted by these objects, drawn out there into the world, are our minds available for self-inquiry to discover the true nature of oneself, which happens to be the true source of joy? This is, I think, what Sri Shankaracharya means here. Gudham, hidden. Atma is hidden in what sense? Our minds are so extrovert that Atma remains hidden. It's the old story. I look for my glasses everywhere. I'm looking outside everywhere. My very effort to find my glasses out there causes my glasses to remain hidden. Correct? That's exactly what these two words mean. Gudham, anupravishtam. Atma is gudham, hidden. How is it hidden? Our attention is misdirected out into the world, and in that way, what we seek is veiled from our attention. Our attention is misdirected. So, gudham, anupravishtam. Hidden, and covered by our attention being misdirected outside, whereas where consciousness can be discovered is not out there, is in here. Now, pardon me for being a little silly, in here means what? In your spleen. Sorry for being silly. I have no idea what is a spleen and where it is, I have no idea. It's in there someplace. Okay. Just being silly here. Within is correct. Where? Well, we get some hint right here. As Sakshi, it is that by which mental events are known. Where are mental events located? In your mind. Therefore, where does the observation or witnessing of mental events take place? In your mind. Where is this consciousness located, if we want to use the word location? If it's located anywhere, it's located in your mind. That's what this expression means. Guha hitam. It is hitam, it is placed, it abides. Where? Guha. Guha literally means cave, and then the full expression is cave of the heart, and then cave of the heart ends up being a metaphor for mind. Simply means mind. Guha hitam. It abides in your mind. And here we don't want to differentiate between manas and buddhi and chitta and all of this stuff. Just mind in general. Just keep it very simple. It abides in your mind. Why does it abide in your mind? Let's be very clear. It abides in your mind because that's where vrittis are known. You don't know vrittis in your spleen or in any other organ. That knowing takes place in your mind. Consciousness abides in your mind. Since it abides in your mind, where do you think we should look to discover its true nature? In the mind. All right, guha hitam. But now there's another problem. It's guha hitam, abides in your mind, but it is gahwareshtam, another unusual expression. Gahwara is a term often used to describe like a thick jungle or thicket, something that's impenetrable. Like if you go walking in the woods, sometimes the undergrowth is so thick you can't walk through it. That is gahwara, a thicket. Here, in the mind, we have to deal with what very aptly could be called a thicket of thoughts. True. A thicket of thoughts. A thicket in the woods is something that is so dense as to be impenetrable. A thicket of thoughts is thinking so convoluted and so active as to be impenetrable. Our minds are often on overdrive, and we experience that thicket of thoughts most of the day. Even at night, if you have a hard time falling asleep, why is that? Those thoughts keep going and going and going. One important reason to practice meditation is to cut through that thicket of thoughts. It makes this discovery more difficult. Consciousness is present, but to discover its true nature is made more difficult by the intensity of our thoughts, by the number of our thoughts, by the convoluted nature of our thoughts. So that thicket of thoughts, gahroireshtam. So consciousness is present in that thicket of thoughts. How is it present in the thicket of thoughts? There's a thicket of thoughts, vrittis. And that thicket of thoughts is sakshya. It is being witnessed. It is being witnessed by who? You. You witness your own thicket of thoughts. But the presence of that thicket of thoughts prevents you from really understanding who's watching it. So this is the point here. And finally, it says that consciousness is puranam. Self, atma, is puranam. Purana literally means old. How old? Silly. So words are used suggestively here. So old here doesn't mean relatively old, 100 years old. Old here means absolutely old. What do you mean absolutely old? The best way of explaining that is to say uncreated, unborn. The consciousness we're referring to, the self, atma, we're referring to. Unborn. Let's start with unborn. Before your body was born, consciousness was there. But even though consciousness was there, you couldn't experience anything because consciousness can be there, you can be there, but unless there's something to be aware of, there's no possibility of knowing anything. As consciousness, you existed before birth, but you were not aware of anything because in order to be aware of anything, you need vrittis, right? In order to have vrittis, you need a mind. In order to have a mind, you need a brain. In order to have a brain, you need a body. You get the point? So prior to birth, there's no vehicle for experience, yet consciousness existed. That's what we mean by unborn. Step further, uncreated. It's not that one day Ishvara said, let me create some atmas. Ishvara doesn't create atmas. Ishvara created the world. Where have you heard Ishvara? You actually laughed at that expression, Ishvara creating atmas. You've never heard such a thing because it's utterly untrue. Ishvara creates the world, Jagatkarta, creator of the world. World includes your body and my body, your mind and my mind, But world does not include Atma. How can world not include Atma? Well, this is what we're talking about. World is over here. Atma is over here. Ishvara created world. Ishvara did not create Atma. Atma and Ishvara are co-existent, co-eternal, we could say. Both unborn, uncreated, that Atma. And then the text goes on to say that Atma is Adhyatma Yoga Adhigamena. It is Matva, having discovered Devam, that shining one, that Atma, that shining consciousness, the one that illumines your mind and thoughts, mental activities. Matva, having understood how, Adhyatma Yoga Adhigamena. By Adhigama, by understanding or by employing Adhyatma Yoga. Oh, just what we need is another yoga, right? We already have Karma Yoga, we have Jnana Yoga, we have Bhakti Yoga, we have Raja Yoga, we have Laya Yoga, we have Nada Yoga. People go on making up yogas nowadays. Of course, many are traditional, so some are practicing Hatha Yoga and all of this. So now we have one more yoga we're supposed to practice. That's not what the expression means. Adhyatma Yoga means a practice which is adhyatma. Adhyatma iti adhyatma. That which focuses on the self, Sri Shankara explains, Vishayebhya prati samhritya chetasaha, taking your mind and grabbing it and directing it away from all worldly experiences, all worldly objects, and atmani samadhanam. And focusing that mind, atmani, on one's own self. Adhyatma literally means towards atma. And Shankara explains, it's a process of redirecting your attention away from worldly activities, directing that attention towards the true self within. That is Adhyatma Yoga. So, matva devam, having understood, having grasped the reality of your true self, Adhyatma Yoga Adhigamena, through this process of redirecting your attention, dhiraha, an intelligent person, a committed person, a firm person, this person, jahati, casts off, gets rid of harsha and shoka, gets rid of, you can't take this too literally, again, you become free from harsha, elation, and shoka, sadness. Don't take it too literally. Do you think enlightened people can't smile and laugh or cry? An enlightened person can laugh or cry, but there's a difference. Inside, the enlightened person is always the same. Consciousness is always the same. Mind is involved in laughter and crying. Consciousness illumines laughter and crying. Laughter and crying, or I should say harsha and shoka, elation and sadness, take place in the mind. When elation takes place in the mind in the form of vrittis, when you're happy, do you know you're happy? Yeah. When you're sad, do you know you're sad? Yeah. So then who is happy and who is sad? If happiness and sadness, watch this, if happiness and sadness, which are in the form of vrittis, are known to you, who gets happy and who gets sad? Happiness and sadness are known to you. They're objects of your knowledge. You are not the one getting happy and sad. Happiness and sadness is happening to your mind. Then why do we say, I am happy, I am sad? This is a problem that we're dealing with. This is a confusion. Look at that. Let's take a moment here, and then we'll finish up this verse, move on to the next one. how common it is to say, I am happy, I am sad. Or more, I am Swami Tadatmananda. I am male, I am so many years old, I am this, I am that, whatever it is. These statements are all bogus. I don't know what word to use. They're nonsense. Because we take an object, something on the right-hand side of that chart, we take an object and label it as I. How silly is that? An object seen by you, like a pen, I see the pen, therefore I am a pen. Nonsense, right? I see the pen, therefore I am not a pen. I see my body, therefore I am not this body. I witness my sadness and happiness, therefore I am not my sadness and happiness. How crucial this is. I witness my happiness and sadness. By definition, I am not that. It's witnessed by me, therefore it's not me. Who am I? I am that consciousness. We haven't seen it yet here. We could maybe puranam, we can interpret it. Actually, we can go back and pick up that word puranam and put another twist on it. Puranam, unborn, uncreated, we could extend it, unchanging. Puranam doesn't mean unchanging, but by extension. That which doesn't get born isn't created, which means something that's not undergoing changes. To be born is a change of condition. Your condition changes from being unborn to born. To be created is a change of condition, to go from non-existent to existent. So to be born or created is a change of condition. To be unborn, uncreated, puranam, means to not undergo change. Therefore, we're just extending the meaning of that word to mean changeless. The consciousness which you are is changeless. Happiness comes and goes. You remain the unchanging consciousness illumining happiness and sadness as they come and go. Like clouds covering the sun. A dark cloud covers the sun. The sun goes on shining nonetheless. A rainbow is formed in the sky. The sun goes on shining. The sun isn't changed by the presence or absence of the rainbow. The sun isn't changed by the presence or absence of a cloud. We look at the dark clouds, we feel sad. We look at the bright rainbow, we feel happy. That's our normal human response. The sun is unchanged in the same way your consciousness is unchanged. Therefore, dhiraha, a wise person having understood the true nature of Atma, harsha shokau, elation, and sadness jahati, casts off, transcends. Let's go on.
Etat shrutva, samparigrihya martyaha, pravrihya dharmyam, anumetam hapya, samurate, muraniyam hi labdhva, vivritam sadma, nachiketa sammanye.
Etat shrutva, having heard etat, this what? These teachings which Yama is teaching to Nachiketas, these teachings which are recorded in the Upanishads, not just this Katha Upanishad, but in all the Upanishads, etat shrutva, having heard this, but hearing is not enough. Let's be very clear. You know, the American expression is very apt here, right? You goes in one ear, comes out the other. I heard what you said. when you're in an argument, right? Someone is shouting at you, I heard what you said. What does it mean? In one ear, out the other. But here, etat shrutva, having heard these profound teachings, and not merely having heard, samparigrihya martyaha. Martyaha, a mortal person. A mortal person who, having heard these teachings, and samparigrihya, very nice, the Sanskrit here is especially nice. Grih is to grasp. Grihya, having grasped. Grasped not in a physical sense, but grasped in an intellectual sense. But there are two prefixes used here. By the way, for our Sanskrit students, this is a gerund with two upasargas. For our Sanskrit students, gerund with two upasargas. First upasarga means prefix. First upasarga is pari. Pari grihya. Grihya means to grasp. Pari, paritaha, in entirety, on all sides. Sometimes you grasp something in a very narrow manner. These profound teachings could be grasped in a very narrow manner. But here, pari grihya, grasping them completely, no aspect left ununderstood. And another prefix is samyak, well. To grasp completely and perfectly. Samparigrihya. To grasp completely and perfectly, which means not as a concept, not as an idea, not as an abstraction. These teachings are not about a concept called Atma. Why? Atma is not a concept. Look on the board. Any concept is something known, right? A concept is something that can be known. If a concept can be known, it's an object. Atma, by definition, is not a concept. Not an abstraction, not an idea, not a philosophical principle, all of which would be in this category of objects. Atma is you, the conscious being, which is the essence of who you are. Samparigrihya, understanding that true self completely and perfectly. Pravrihya, and having separated what? Isn't that, this demarcating line is pretty important, don't you think? This is more important than Lakshman Rekha. This is Atma Anatma Rekha. The division between Atma and Anatma. What is our word here? Pravrihya means to divide, to separate. To separate anatma from atma, to separate objects of consciousness from consciousness, to separate mental events from the witness, to separate objects that are seen from the seer, to separate object from subject, pravrihya, having separated. And apya, at the end of the line, apya, having gained etam, this one which is dharmyam and anum. Dharmyam, dharma anapetam, that which is an expression of dharma, and dharma can have many meanings, one of which could be essence. Dharma can mean essence. So dharmyam, that essence of who you are, which is anum. Now, anu is a fairly common word. It means atom. Anu. When it's used in a context like this, it doesn't exactly mean atom. It happens to mean subtle. Subtle, as opposed to gross. Gross would be something physical. Subtle or sukshma is something not physical, subtle. Here, anu is used in the sense of subtle. So that which is apya, having gained, having understood, having discovered, that which is dharmyam, the essence of who you are, which is anu, subtle. I actually took the time to go through my notes from 1987, when I studied this text with Pujya Swami Dayananda, and we studied it with Shankara's commentary, and I took some notes, and I observed that sometimes Pujya Swami Dayananda would add in his own things, some of which were incredibly helpful insights. I'd like to share one of those insights with you right now about that word anu. So this is something that Pujya Swamiji brought into the text. It's not found in Shankara's commentary or any other commentary, to my knowledge. But it's a very profound understanding of what do we mean by subtle. Anu here means sukshma. That's what it means. Sukshma means subtle. What do we mean by subtle? And he made this really, I've never seen this done before. In fact, I've forgotten about it until I read my notes. It's been a long time. So he made an interesting point. With regard to the nature of Atma, he said that if you go from gross to subtle, you increase in pervasiveness. So gross is that which is non-pervading. And as something becomes more subtle, it becomes increasingly pervasive. That's very abstract, so I'm going to give you his example, which I thought was so simple but profound. He says, take something fairly gross like ice. Ice is gross. Gross in the sense of physical, it forms a cube, it forms a block, it forms a physical thing, and it's contained in that physical thing. In that sense, it doesn't pervade anything. It's stuck. It's very limited, spatially limited. So in fact, non-pervading is a funny term. How about spatially limited? And therefore, we go towards spatially limitless on this end. I'm not sure if that's the correct spelling, but it'll do. So here's his point. If you start with ice, ice is in a block, a cube. It's spatially limited, confined. Now we go to something progressively more subtle. What would be somewhat more subtle than ice would be water. Now, water is very different than ice in that it's not stuck in a form. In fact, water conforms to whatever form you put it in. If you put water in a glass, it fills up the glass. If you put water in a tub, it conforms to the dimensions of the tub. So water is less spatially limited. It has the ability to conform to whatever object you put it in. So its edges or boundaries are less fixed. The edges or boundaries of ice, absolutely fixed. The edges of boundaries of water, less fixed. There's still an edge. In any container you put water, it will still have an edge. So it's less spatially limited. Then take it one more step. Vapor, steam. Not steam, water vapor. In the air that we're breathing right now, there's water vapor. You can't see it. So steam is something you can see. There's water vapor right now in the air. There's humidity. That's water vapor. So you can't see it, but it is certainly there. And what Pujya Swamiji's point was, is that water vapor is increasingly more subtle. Here we go from the grossest form, ice, to something less gross, less
stula, more sukshma, water, going a further step to vapor. And what about vapor? How spatially limited is it? It just goes. If you put it in a glass, it won't stay there. It just goes everywhere. So in a sense, it pervades more. Now, his point then is as we go from that which is physical to that which is non-physical, as we go from that which is stula to that which is sukshma, or anu, that's our word in the text, we simultaneously go from that which is spatially limited to that which is spatially limitless. So let's now apply this to our Vedantic teachings. We start with the physical body, which, like a block of ice, is we got a hard surface. That's the edge. That's all it is. But you all know that inside this physical body is prana, life. That prana or life is not a physical entity that you can touch, but it certainly exists. In fact, that prana not only comes in the body, but it kind of fills up every corner from toe to nose or whatever edges you want to talk about. So just like water fills up the cup, we could say prana fills up this body, prana being less stula, less gross, prana being more subtle. It then fills this body, so then we'll let prana be equivalent to water. And then, and this is a metaphor, so don't take it too seriously, and don't get stuck on it. What about this consciousness? Consciousness is much less subtle, I'm sorry, much less stula, much less gross compared to body and even prana. I'll use the word chit here for consciousness. And if the body is spatially limited, if prana is less spatially limited, and that is it conforms to the body, then consciousness, chit or chaitanya, is less spatially limited, in fact, spatially limitless, which means not confined to the body. Now, why did we go through all of this? This is what all of this is implied by that word anu. Anu here doesn't mean atom. Anu here means subtle. And subtle, as Pujaswamiji suggests, that which is most subtle is that which has no edge, no boundary, no spatial limit whatsoever, which means it has no particular location. If it has no particular location, if water vapor is everywhere and consciousness is everywhere, then why do we say guha hitam? It abides in the mind. Turns out that consciousness is everywhere, but the place we're going to find it and understand it, I shouldn't say find it, the place where consciousness can be understood is in your mind. Consciousness is all pervasive, which means there's no place where it is not, but where will that all-pervasive consciousness truly be understood? Only in your mind. And we'll come back to all of that in our next class. So we've just done the first two lines of this verse. We'll finish this verse. After this verse, and Nachiketas asks more questions. He's not done. More questions come, and Yama has more answers to follow. We'll see that in our next class. We'll conclude with our prayers.